Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Daily Friend Show. I'm going to be your host for today. My name is Magoni Maja. Unfortunately, Nicholas is away after suffering a bit of an injury, but he's fine. He should return sometime mid next week, but the show will continue. There'll be other hosts other than myself for Monday and Tuesday. So don't worry, we will still be broadcasting on the allotted schedule every single day. For now, I am going to introduce my co-hosts. I'm joined by Anlu Kieva and Marius Ruart. Anlu, how's your Friday
Hello.
going?
Going very well. Happy to be back. It's been a while.
We're very glad to have you back. Marius, what about you? How's your Friday going?
Yeah, not too bad. It's nice to be a Friday. Nice to be the one among the roses, yeah.
Yeah, we'll accept one thorn among the roses. And jumping into today's stories, the first one is concern from Old Mutual. They are ringing the alarm on the risks of the 2.2 pots retirement system that threaten people's livelihoods and, as Old Mutual cautions, could leave people very poor in retirement. Old Mutual also expresses worry about the rising youth unemployment, and will link those towards the end. So this is from Old Mutual's head of financial education, reported by Daily Investor, and he says it is certainly concerning, given what we know, that for the longest time, the number of people who can retire adequately in South Africa has been staggering at 6%. So, with this type of early withdrawals, we expect people will retire very poor. And he gives this figure of just how much they received in withdrawals initially, and he ranks it at 4 billion rand. And he So profiles the people who are making these withdrawals. He says they are primarily between the ages of 31 and 40, and drills further down by saying the highest of those people are between the ages of 36 and 40, and that the majority of them earn between 5,000 and 10,000 rand in income. So, Andrew, let me come to you first. These are clearly very economically vulnerable people. You know, I mean, 5 to 10,000 rand is meager income, and clearly either within the youth bracket or just outside of the youth bracket, and they're already feeling the financial pressure and dipping into their retirement savings. How are you making sense of this story?
Perhaps it's important to just explain a little bit if somebody has missed it. The reform essentially split pre-retirement. It split it into two parts. The one third for short-term savings, and then two thirds locked in essentially until you retire. And the idea was really just to strike a balance between allowing people a little bit more flexibility and also a little bit liquidity in the case of an emergency. But the thing is that now, rather than it being almost a savings mechanism, it's become a bit of a, it can defer a lot into the long term. And yeah, it's a very serious issue. As a point of interest, the initially in the first 10 days after it was from the 1st of September after it came into effect, 160,000 people withdrew collectively 4.1 billion rand. And now Old Mutual is warning that many of these are, as you said, Makone, young working class individuals, perhaps on a little bit of a lower bracket, but still working class individuals. And many of these are the people who perhaps are growing their families now, and they are making these early withdrawals. And as he also pointed out in that article, it's not really showing on the balance sheets on the perhaps some debt being paid off, or even they're making alternative investments. So it's showing us something very important, which is that yes, people are clearly under financial pressure. But what really stood out to me here is that there's uncertainty in the air, in the economy, and people are really anxious about employment, about their wages, about the cost of living, but also just about the future in general. If you're in your mid-30s, you're raising a child, you're unsure whether you're going to make it through the month, tapping into whatever is liquid, it really does, it starts looking like the only option you have. So there's some serious risks in this. The policy was initially designed to stimulate short-term consumption and drive demand, and they were looking for it to be a way to boost the GDP. And according to Saab forecasts for the next 2 years, it is expected to still increase a little bit in terms of GDP, like between 0.3 and 0.7 percentage points over the next 2 years, and perhaps some tax revenue increases. But yeah, that definitely does not. We often know that short-term gains can have a long-term price tag, if you want to call it that. And if we look at the macroeconomic effects in the long term, if people take too many of their immediate liquidity out, we might perhaps that burden of old age poverty can transfer right back into the state or onto the state. And again, the young people who actually then have to pay for those, the budgets that will have to carry the older people. So yeah, there's also a lot of responsibility on the people who are actually facilitating this to help the members and the public to understand and to properly navigate the system as soon as the thrall also starts wearing off. So yeah, there's some clear responsibility for guidance and support needed. Yeah, it's a very serious issue, but we'll have to see how it plays off in the longer term. It's unfortunately outside of the forecasting timeline.
I think you raise crucial points there, especially when you discuss, you know, looking into the long term and how we will inherit the instance where you have a large population of the elderly in future being impoverished. And Manike, the head of education at Old Mutual, also draws in the issue of unemployment to make this case that because we have such a high youth unemployment, and Marius, I'll come to you with this, the high youth unemployment delays people getting into the work market, being able to already start making those retirement savings early on. And as a result, they will be maybe heavily dependent on the state in future because they only started saving their retirement much later in life. And if they're making these gigantic withdrawals from those savings, then they will likely be even more vulnerable once they are retired. What do you have to say about this?
Well, I think it's all to do with the poor economy South Africa has. You say it's youth unemployment, people take longer to get jobs, and the employment can be quite precarious. And as the saying goes, when you're saving money for retirement, it's not about timing the markets, it's about time in the market. So if you can stay saved for 40 years, whatever the case is, and you don't have to withdraw money, you're going to be probably fairly well set for your retirement. But if you only start working, you know, when you're 30, whatever the case is, or you have to withdraw money when you're 35, you have to withdraw 20% of your pension because you've lost your job or because somebody close to you has lost their job and you need to help them out or whatever the case is. That has all kinds of knock-on effects. And there's a reason why your retirement annuity before these reforms, you could only touch it when you turn 55, because to protect people from themselves, actually, so that they wouldn't go dip into their retirement savings. And I mean, that money is also protected from your creditors and so on. If you owe somebody money, that they also can come for your retirement annuity. But obviously now if that money's become liquid and you can put it into your bank account, then that money can get taken. I mean, as that article shows, a lot of this money has been going to pay off debt and so on. And that's not what this is for. But this all comes down to the very weak economy South Africa has at the moment. You know, if we had an unemployment rate closer to what we have in other middle income countries, where it's, you know, 15% or even 20%, things would be a lot different. But we effectively have an unemployment rate of 50% if we include people who include discouraged work seekers. And I think this is all those knock-on effects. And the only solution is economic growth. The only way you're going to be able to create jobs is through economic growth. And unfortunately, the government still seems to think that the best way to get things moving is to kind of move money around and to move wealth around, not to create new wealth. And we're going to be sitting with this situation for a long time until we start to reform the economy and getting growth going.
That's why the council, time in the market rather than timing the market. I think that's also why Marius' retirement annuity contributions are so low, right? But when you only start working later and you start contributing later as well, then you have to sort of catch up by trying to set aside a lot more money so that, you know, you can still retire somewhat decently with a decent pool of money ready for you once you leave the job market. There's one note here that I wanted to highlight for those who are curious about what exactly these people are using the money for. Given, I mean, yeah, like Andrew raised those pressures of if you're in your mid-30s, you know, you're likely supporting a family and that can have its own pressures. But according to Manike, these people are using the money to, he says, pay off their debts. He says, however, when you look at the reports from banking institutions, he doesn't think it will confirm that they are, in fact, paying off their debts. And he says, it's not like people are using the savings pot to buy cars. So it seems the financial system, the financial institutions, as integrated, as interconnected as they are still not able to trace, you know, where this huge surplus of money is coming from being injected through retirement money, where exactly it's flowing to. So it's a curious case there. Anlu, if you have any final comments before we address the growth outlook, which is also by Old Mutual, I'd gladly welcome those comments.
Yeah, I think Marius made a very good point that they're instead just moving around money instead of actually creating wealth for people. And I mentioned earlier the Saab's forecast for perhaps potential growth impacts that this might have, or GDP growth impacts that it might have. But if you actually look, and we'll get to the story on growth in a moment, but if you actually look at ways to create growth, then this is certainly not one of those.
Indeed. So, speaking about growth, since you've both mentioned it, this is another story by Old Mutual, which is warning that South Africa will never get the growth it needs. Very antithetical to the positive attitudes of many of us here at the Daily Friend. But it's comments from Johan Els, who is Old Mutual's chief economist, was outlining, you know, the difficulty in reaching those significant growth milestones and growth rates in his mid-year economic outlook. And he says that whilst there have been some reforms aimed at logistics and electricity and infrastructure like water, they need to be matched with an overhaul of its labor market and deeper pool of skills. He said that if South Africa wants to effectively address its unemployment crisis, it would need to grow the economy at above 5% of the annual rate. And Lou, I'm going to come back to you on this one. I know you have a lot to say about the growth outlook. It hasn't been good for the past decade. It's been grim, actually. We've just spoken about, you know, how much pressure people are economically, but outside of that, there's still the case of millions who are unemployed. What do you have to say about Mr. Els's reflections about our prospects of growing the economy?
Well, I broadly agree with him. He did a very quick explanation, but if I can just extrapolate a little bit, he explained that in the short run, if we want growth, it is expected to some extent to come from cyclical factors, which are those ups and downs in the economy. And those naturally happen over time. And if you look at specific examples of these, lower interest rates makes it a little bit cheaper to borrow, so you can buy cars and houses and stuff like that. And lower inflation, which will then, say, improve people's purchasing power, so they'll be able to stretch their money a little bit further. And both these do encourage consumer spending. So people tend to spend more, and that boosts demand, and essentially short-term economic growth can happen. But if you want long-term sustained economic growth and you want to actually improve economic growth over the long term, we can't rely on the short-term consumer spending trends. For the economy to grow steadily over years, the country needs more investment. It needs businesses to build factories. It needs infrastructure to be upgraded. And we need essentially, and this is what he gets to, the point he makes is that we need also structural constraints to be addressed. We need those deep-rooted problems like our poor unemployment rates. like the straining labor market regulations, excuse me, my tongue twisters, red tape. We need those things to be addressed. So yeah, the reality is that South Africa has been in a low growth trap for over a decade. And if we look at GDP per capita rates in other countries, the global average has climbed essentially 34%, and we've gone nowhere. We've stayed essentially the same. And we see these consequences also in things like unemployment. And as people know, and it's a well-known fact that we've also done in many of our own research, particularly the Blueprint for Growth papers, we've pointed out that luckily for us and for the economy, there is a formula for economic growth. And yeah, we constantly refer back to it being founded in the basics of protecting life and liberty and property. We need to expand our investment in the country. And through that, we'll start to raise the growth rate and increase fixed capital formation. And then we need to build and maintain the economic and social infrastructure needed to actually build a solid foundation for the economy. And then we can start translating it, this increased growth, into things like increased employment. So yeah, South Africa, definitely, I'm also hopeful, just as Johan Els is, and we'll see where this goes.
Marius, one of the things Els does is point the mirror in on the South African labor force. He highlights that in addition to, you know, the structural impediments that we've had that Anlu's just listed, there's also a mismatch of skills. He refers to, or the article rather, refers to a recent economic survey by South Africa of the OECD development countries, who analyzed this mismatch between worker qualifications and available jobs in South Africa, and that it leaves graduates unable to find employment because they are not, their skills, the degrees are not suitable for the jobs that are required in the labor market. What do we think about this?
Yeah, I mean, there's probably something to that, but we're going to have this kind of problem when we're growing at less than 1% a year. If we're growing at 5-6% a year, these jobs, obviously, the jobs will be created, and there, maybe people won't be doing their dream job, but they'll be doing something that's kind of matched to their skills, what have you. And still in South Africa, if you're a graduate, you're still far less likely to be unemployed than if you only have a matric or if you didn't finish school. I think the overall unemployment rate for graduates is still only about 10%. And obviously the overall unemployment rate for South Africa is 30% on the strict definition and about 50% on the expanded definition. But I mean, that's what it comes down to. It's the only way we're going to get jobs is through economic growth. And I mean, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. And that's exactly what's happened in South Africa, especially over the past 20 years. We've been stuck with pushing the same kinds of bad policies, creating investor uncertainty. And we're not going to get fixed investments, as Anu says. I mean, you need people to come here to build factories and to, you know, actually build things and whatever. I mean, there's just an article now that the JSE is going to reach its highest level ever. But that's all well and good. That's all what they like to call hot money. I mean, Anu can correct me, but it's money that's very easy to put into a country, but very easy to pull out again. People are only going to come build factories and invest real money in real infrastructure if they know the investment's going to be safe. That means you can't have things like expropriation without compensation. That means you also can't actually have these hard BE quotas, because nobody's going to come to South Africa and be told who they're allowed to hire. And, you know, that you can't hire the best guy for the job. You've got to fill certain racial quotas. No company's going to go do that. And South Africa, you know, South Africans have a very high opinion of themselves. And this includes everybody. But the government thinks that we are the special country that somehow deserves money and investment. That's not true. There are, well, whatever it is. I think there's 206 countries, like in the United Nations, whatever the case is. We're just one of them. We're trying to get the same money as Indonesia is, or India, or Kenya, whatever the case is. And they're going to go. Money's like water. It flows where to the path of least resistance. And South Africa has created a lot of resistance for money to come in and for investments. And we're going to be stuck in this very low growth, 0.5%, whatever it is, for the foreseeable future, unless things change. And unfortunately, with the current governments, I don't see that happening. But that all said, it's often in crisis that reforms start happening. If you look at apartheid South Africa at the end of the 1980s, the place was falling apart. Obviously, there was violence. The government was basically broke. That's when you started seeing reforms. India in the early 1990s was the same. India basically, it didn't have any money. It had to airlift, this is a true story, it literally had to airlift gold from the UK to be able to pay its debtors. And what happened since 1991, the Indian economy then started reforming. It got rid of what was called the license Raj, where you basically had to have a license for everything. You had to have like a license for your shoes, basically. And they got rid of all those kinds of things. Since then, the Indian economy has grown on average about 6% every year since 1991. Imagine South Africa had grown at 6% a year since 1991. This country would be unrecognizable. But as I say, it's when you get to crisis that reform often happens. But that also said, a lot of times you get to crisis and people double down. I think Zimbabwe and Venezuela are two good examples of when crisis happens and the government doesn't do what they should be doing and they double down on bad policies. And that is still a very real risk in South Africa.
Yeah, it sounds like India hit rock bottom there, and that South Africa may need to follow suit in order to take the cautionary tale seriously. And in doubling down, I mean, there's still a responsibility on the citizens to either keep this government or get a new one. Did you want to add something to that, Mario? Sorry, I saw you take off your mute option.
No, I was just going to say with India, one thing that still boggles my mind is that in the 1960s and 1970s, they used to talk about something called the Hindu rate of growth because India's economy was growing very slowly compared to other developing countries. I thought that Hindu rate of growth was maybe 1%. It was 4%. So we would right now kill for an economic growth rate of 4%. It's Indeed. Completely bonkers.
Oh, the things we would do for 4% growth rate, Marius, over the last 10 years. But we haven't even managed just one. So we're really scraping the bottom of the barrel. And like you say, our highest sense of self as a country hasn't served us. In fact, you know, it's just gotten us drilling more into these labor market constraints like BEE, like the employment equity. I mean, the tightening the screws on employment equity earlier this year for me was a clear sign that this is the government, the likes of Venezuela, as you say, you know, in times of crisis, it seems that they want to double down and go even harder on those policies that have clearly failed. And did you have any concluding comments on all of what Marius has shared?
I think we should start calling Marius, I don't know, the nice quote man or something, because he's just throwing out spitting verses today, the path of least resistance. And I think that's very important. That's something we should definitely take into the weekend. We need to, if we want more economic growth in the country, we need to be the path of least resistance. And it does not seem that we're heading that way. So yeah, nothing more to add, but yeah, very good. Path of least resistance. We'll rename South Africa.
Once we flatten down all those mountains to economic growth constraints, then I think we can be the path of least resistance and flood in all the growth that we need. The second story for today is about the PIC, the State Pension Fund Manager, which has lended the corruption mired poultry group Daybreak Foods another 150 million rand in support to support the company as it resolves and comes to a conclusion of its business rescue proceedings to enable it to pay salaries. So let me start by doing a highline of what the relationship between Daybreak Foods and the PIC is, right? So Daybreak is a privately run company, but the PIC controls 100% of its shares on behalf of its investments. And obviously the PIC is the state pension fund manager. So all civil servants in South Africa have their pensions held and controlled by PIC. So PIC controls 100% of Daybreak's shares and makes investments on behalf of GEPF, the Government Employees Pension Fund, the Compensation Commission, as well as the UIF. You may remember that, you know, Daybreak had a whistleblower allege various corrupt activities that it's involved in, you know, allegations of animal cruelty, financial mismanagement scandals, nothing new to state-owned entities, and which has ultimately led to it being unable to pay its workers and contractors. The company entered into business rescue proceedings. There were calls for greater transparency and accountability, and that's what triggered the parliamentary proceedings and criminal investigations into the company. Now, the scandal for the day is that the PIC has awarded, and I'm using that word carefully, awarded the corrupt Daybreak Foods 150 million in addition to the 250 million they've already provided it to this year in order to save the company from litigation because they are worried about jobs. There's 300,000 jobs that are at risk here. And the idea is that many of these jobs are in rural areas. But the PIC Deputy Minister David Masondo also issued a statement saying that they're hopeful that PIC, if it turns around, it'll be able to make profits in the range of 300 to 400 million. Marius, are you as optimistic as the PAC and Deputy Minister Masondo about this possible recovery and offshoot straight into, you know, hundreds of millions in profit?
I don't know enough about the company, but I would be very surprised if it is if we are going to see these kinds of you know, huge increases in profits and whatever. It's also, I mean, the PRC is the single, it's probably the single biggest investor in the whole of Africa, actually. It's got blood, it's got huge amounts of money under control, under its control. And obviously government employees' pensions come out of it. But one of the problems is that government employees, as far as I understand, they have what they call defined, their pension is that they will get their pension, it doesn't matter how much money is in the government employee pension fund. So other people who have private pensions, such as probably the three of us here, whatever, if you haven't saved enough, whatever the case is, or if the pension fund collapses, that's sorry for you. That's not the case with the government employee pension fund. And I think that's also why you often see that there isn't pressure on the PRC to make sure that they are investing in the right place and so on. Look, that they have a lot of good investments. If you look at any big company on the JSE, it's generally about 10% of it's owned by the PRC. But it's also, it's been invested in a lot of shady companies as well. I'm open to correction, but I think it was in, also invested in Sekunjalo, which was Iqbal Survey's vehicle to buy independent newspapers and so on. So overall, this is something to keep an eye on. I think it is pretty concerning. Dave Masondo, even though he's a communist, he's one of the more sensible communists. And I believe he is actually somebody who understands the importance of things like economic growth and so on. So yeah, it's something to keep an eye on, but it's definitely, I think it's also something to be a bit concerned about because the PRC is actually a very important entity in South Africa. And it's one that's actually got a lot of economic clout. And also just when people tell you that, you know, the JSE is owned only by white people or whatever the case is, the PRC is a government entity and it is the biggest single investor on the JSE. And as I said, it's probably the single biggest investor as an entity in the whole of Africa. So yeah, it's just as I said, it's an important entity, and hopefully it's it doesn't you know, go the way of things like the post office or PRAS or whatever the case is.
As you highlight the importance of the PIC, I'm also thinking of their fiduciary duty to their investors, which is South African workers, right? And it seems to be that they're carrying out this exercise negligently, you know, to say, let's just give them money until business rescue is concluded, which also doesn't help because one thing that incentivizes business rescue to go on quickly is that salaries need to be paid out. But if you're just bankrolling them continuously in the hopes that, you know, even if they do come out on the other side of this business rescue proceedings, it's not necessarily conclusive that there won't be any more money required from the PIC to make it into Daybreak. So I'm thinking of their fiduciary duty there, and it seems to be absent, Andlu. How are you making sense of them balancing the risks to jobs against, you know, continuing to give them money to prevent those risks, but also in terms of the fiduciary duty that they have to the investors? Is this the right move for the investors against the jobs that are on the line?
Yeah, I think it's especially worrying that they already have a fallback plan. They say they believe Daybreak is turnaroundable, if that's a word, but they already have a fallback plan in place. They clearly say that even if they fail and they go bankrupt, we are sure that we can get our money back throughout selling their assets and stuff like that. So that definitely does not sound like confidence to me. It's called hedging. And it raises a very serious problem that if you are already planning for the failure, why are you investing the public's money in at all in this entity? Public pension fund contributions, have every reason to feel, contributors have every reason to feel uneasy about this. So the PIC, to Marius's point, they have assets under management worth $172 billion. That's a lot of money. Certainly, as Marius said, the biggest on Africa, on the continent. And it's staggering to me that, so something that stood out to me here is that the PIC has pumped into Daybreak since 2015, 1.7 billion rand, and they've gotten zero returns for that. They value the entire company at zero, like the market value for it's zero. And that tells you essentially everything that you need to know. And we keep hearing whenever there's money being pumped into it, we hear this same old recycled language of it's a conditional loan, it's a short-term loan, we're expecting it back. But nothing, that never materializes. We've seen this in many other instances with Eskom, with SAA, and there are many other state-owned entities that the same language was used and the pattern doesn't seem to change. So yeah, I think this latest round of injections, you also mentioned it, but it's only the beginning, or well, not even the beginning, but it's not going to end. It's continuing. We would be wise to brace ourselves for the next headline to say that more money was invested, and perhaps another after that. It's a bottomless pit. The PIC, we need serious explanation for why they are continuing to spend money in it, in this bottomless pit. And I always say this, but it's not the government's responsibility to create employment opportunities. And if that is the reason that 3,000 people will lose their jobs, we'll need them to make a clear stop instead. There's much better opportunities and avenues to follow to actually create job opportunities in the economy.
I was undertaking that exact exercise of going through the state-owned entities that have had corruption allegations made against them. You know, SAA during state capture, Eskom, Transnet, all of them who have had these bailouts given to them, and whether they've actually had anything to show for that. You recently, as soon as I think yesterday or today, you had News 24 cover a story about SAA having to rewrite its 2023 and 2024 financial losses due to an accounting error. They thought that, you know, they had actually turned a corner, but it turned out that no, they had made another loss, yet billions and billions have just been sunk into the state-owned entities. And they never have to account because they rely on entities like the PIC, which hold government employees hostage. They literally hold all their retirement investments hostage and have the sole responsibility of managing those funds carefully. But clearly that care is not being exercised diligently.
Can I add something to that, Makone?
Go ahead.
It also adds to the uncertainty that we spoke about in the previous story, with people actually feeling that they need to withdraw more money from their early retirement. That it certainly does not instill confidence in the public.
Indeed. All right. I hope you've all enjoyed the show. We've actually gone 4 minutes over time. There will be episodes on Monday and Tuesday of the Daily Friend Show and the Daily Friend Wrap Show. But until then, I hope you have a wonderful weekend. See you next week.